Welcome to 7 Things EMS, a continuing education offering from Limmer Education. 7 Things EMS is designed to give you what you need to succeed in EMS. It's conversational, informational, and without the fluff.
All right, and welcome to this episode of 7 Things EMS. I'm your host, Dan Limmer, and I've got an awesome guest today, Dr. Ed Dickinson from the University of Pennsylvania, a longtime friend of mine, a true advocate for EMS, someone who approaches EMS as an emergency physician with a true EMS background. And Ed and I worked as paramedics together in the early 1980s. And one of the things we do here, Ed, is we don't talk about our cats and our lives and all the other stuff. We kind of get to business here, but I just have to say how long we've known each other and how much I'm looking forward to doing this podcast.
I appreciate that, Dan.
The other thing that makes me onto this podcast is your passion about stroke and treating strokes, identifying strokes. And the 7 things that we have today, I think, are really going to be an amazing refresher, or for some people, maybe even a primer in really understanding strokes. If you get your textbook chapter on the BFAST or Cincinnati Stroke Scale or FAST or whatever, we do these things mechanically. I'm not sure we understand. Our purpose today is really to understand those. And our conversation we had before this has got me really excited. So let's jump right in there. And our plan today is to go through our first 5 of the 7 things we're going to do is we're going to break down those elements of stroke scales. So let's hit it with, we'll start with FACE, with the F. Now, FAST, Cincinnati Stroke Scale, whatever you call this, we're going to look at FACE, eyes, and speech first.
Right. So I think, we are so indoctrinated at this point, and the lay public are so indoctrinated in the concept of FAST, looking at the patient, looking at the face for facial asymmetry, looking for speech problems, looking for weakness. That which is a Cincinnati stroke screen we've had a long time, and we kind of build on top of that with a couple extra letters here and there to make it a little bit longer and those sorts of things. And I think that, if we think about how strokes occur, right? So 80%+ of strokes are embolic strokes, not hemorrhagic strokes, right? And it's this group of this 80% where in 2024, there is so much we can do for these patients if we get to them on time. Right. And Dan and I were talking before we went live, back in 1979 as a young EMT, I saw my first 911 response for a massive stroke. I just look at this person who couldn't speak, was completely hemiplegic on one side, and realized in 1979, that was it. That was how that person's going to live the rest of their lives. It's not 1979 anymore. So our need to identify stroke, to get them to the right stroke center, to and to really be there. And it's just so essential. So again, the first things up front, looking at the Cincinnati stroke screen or pre-hospital stroke scale, it's about, looking at the patient. Do they smile for me? Do you have good facial symmetry? Oh, this side is droopy. Oh, that's a positive. Remember, even the basic Cincinnati stroke screen of those 3 screens of facial symmetry, speech, arm drift, limb weakness, one positive, 70%, literature looks like 70% of those patients actually have a stroke. So if you get one positive in there, if you go, oh no, his speech is a little messed up, he's fine because he doesn't have a facial droop, he's not weak. 70% with a single hit, whether it's facial asymmetry, whether it is arm drift, whether it is speech problems and expressive aphasia, 70% chance. You get up to 3 and a 3 positive hit in a Cincinnati stroke screen for those first 3 things, you're at 80%+, 85%. So these are incredibly important diagnostic. It's about sensitivity, right? It's about picking up for it. And it's a very sensitive screen. And when you get multiple hits, it becomes a much more specific screen that you're really looking at stroke. So again, this is not the time to do a half-bungled stroke scale. What I hope we really walk away with today is the concept of methodically going down the list. And on your documentation, methodically showing you did all those things. Because again, we treat everybody like their own family. And I'm now in my 60s. If someone sees me and I'm having a stroke, I want to make sure they nail it too, right, early on and get me where I need to be.
All right. What will an emergency department do? We're just talking about these first 3 things, and we have, I think, a lot more depth to go into. What happens at the emergency department if somebody calls in and says, I've got this, whether it's 1, 2, or 3 of the Cincinnati scale? What do you think as an emergency physician? How do you act?
Well, you know, I think, again, hospitals vary greatly across the country. You know, access to care is very different, and what you get in different ERs is very different. I'm spoiled rotten. I work in an academic comprehensive stroke center where I've got a neurologist in this pocket, a neurosurgeon in this pocket. They get a little heavy by the end of the shift, but they're there with me, you know, in my pockets. But generally, wherever you go, there is an internal, because of the process of JCO and other sort of certifying bodies, there needs to be a process in the emergency department for a stroke alert, right? So you get that EMS call, you know, en route to your facility, 15-minute ETA, 72-year-old person, onset of symptoms, and we'll talk about that, obviously, onset of symptoms 35 minutes ago, now with facial droop and right side of weakness. So that in the ED automatically says, what do I need to do? Well, you know, the mandate is you have to have them through the CAT scanner within 30 minutes. So I'm going to clear my CAT scanner. I'm going to go down to my CAT scan tech, my charger's going to the CAT scan tech and say, I've got a hot stroke coming in. Let's clear this out. In our place, because we're a comprehensive center, we activate for anything up to 24 hours. We use the word hot stroke and cold stroke. So our hot strokes are onset of symptoms within 4.5 hours, because that may be a thrombolytic candidate. So we got to be on top of that, you know, because we'll be giving that medicine in the ER. Or a cold stroke, symptoms more than 4.5 hours, where there might be a candidate for endovascular retrieval of the clot. So again, this 80% group is really important for us to get there, because every hospital can treat with thrombolytics. And every hospital has a plan, hopefully, how to get them to a place where endovascular intervention is possible if they don't have it there. So I think it's really important to activate that. In our place, you know, we alert our neurologist. We have a whole process that gets us kind of rolling along in that way. And in smaller hospitals, the same sort of thing. People are ready to go. They understand the time sensitivity. It's now common. It was a big thing, you know, 15 years ago to talk to EMS, wheel them right to the CAT scanner. We have registration meeting at the front desk. Take them right to the CAT scanner and the EMS stretcher. Take them right there on their striker, right? And now EMS is like upset if you don't tell them to go right to the CAT scanner on the stretcher, which is great. Like, you're going to put them over on our bed? No, hold on a second. And then we say, well, we're just putting them on our bed so we get a good weight. So we're ready to give them the thrombolytics when they get back, because it's all weight-based dosing and stuff like that. But again, we've all bought into this system. So we are very hyper-acute when we get that activation.
Wow, that is really awesome. Now, you mentioned 4.5 hours. That has gradually expanded. I mean, originally we talked 2 hours. Now we're up to 4.5 hours. I guess I'll say that you talked about comprehensive stroke centers. We have different types of stroke centers. What's your advice about transport? You find these face, eyes, and speech. What should the average, you know, EMT, AEMT, or medic, where's their head as far as this time and transport? Obviously, time less seen normal is the T and
right,
fast.
And real reliable. Like, it's the tragedy of waking up with a stroke, right? Because anybody who wakes up with a stroke is not going to get thrombolytics, because we just don't know when their onset was, right? Unless they went to bed an hour ago, right? Most people, we see the awakening stroke, and it's, oh, they're fine at 10:30 when they went to bed, and now it's 9:30 in the morning. We're done. We're going to have to, if we're going to have an intervention, it's going to be, you know, endovascular, because we just don't know the last known normal. It's so important, you know, when you watch us, we're in that dark room in that CAT scanner looking at images coming up, and we're all looking at each other like, did EMS give us a phone number? Who can we talk to? Who really knows the last known normal, right? So, that information being gathered on a scene is as important as, you know, opening the front door of the house. You know, get that information. Okay, you're the husband. What's your cell number? Because you're going to get a call from the hospital. Don't blow off that phone number when it doesn't, you know, it's not one you know. They're not soliciting for, you know, roofing or tiles or something. That's the hospital calling you. Pick up the phone. They're going to call you because they want to know exactly what happened. So I think that's really, really important to have that last known normal for sure. Because otherwise the game, it's a total game changer. And yeah, it's pushed itself out. And that's based on large numbers of studies, large numbers of patients saying, yeah, we can safely do it. We control, you know, even controlling blood pressure better, having, you know, the parameters, you know, because blood pressure in the early days was kind of tricky. Like, we didn't know what the best blood pressure parameter is, because again, these are ischemic strokes. You can't drop the blood pressure too much, because you want to still perfuse other parts of the brain, because they need to have that pressure, right? I think it's really, really important to understand that, you know, we do have that 4.5 hour window now. And if you're a pre-hospital provider and you say, okay, 2 hours ago, and I have to drive an extra 45 minutes to get to a endovascular capable hospital just in case, or to a primary stroke center or comprehensive stroke center, most EMS systems now are building that in, right? And as you know, Dan, in rural areas, that can be a helicopter activation. Right, that can be, we got to get them there. Why? Because it makes a huge difference. And it's not just difference. Well, it's difference fundamentally what we do, right? It's getting the person the best possible care for the best possible outcome and the least morbidity possible from a stroke. And it's also economically, if you can turn somebody around and they literally walk out of the hospital without a neurological problem or maybe just with a little problem with their speech versus them being in a state where they're going to have required care, sometimes in a nursing home or a skilled facility because of the stroke they never got better from, economically it makes sense too. Yeah, it's a big charge for the helicopter up front, but down the road, that's pennies in the bucket for someone who's going to be impaired. So yeah, it really is important. And I don't think there's hardly any EMS system in the country now that's not looking at giving the authority to the pre-op provider to say, you screen positive for a large vessel occlusion, we're going to bypass Happy Valley local general hospital that's not even a stroke center, not even a primary stroke center, right? And we're going to go to a higher level of care because the time saves, you know, as an ER doc who's worked in community hospitals, you know, transfer is never easy, right? And the clock's ticking. And just because it says up to 24 hours, dude, you want that clock pulled out of your head at hour 6.1, not at hour 23.9, right? Because that's brain. That's brain being lost. That's brain at risk. So again, anything we can do to expedite that they're the best level stroke center possible. And again, I'm spoiled rotten. I'm outside of Philadelphia. You know, I can swing a dead cat and hit a stroke center, right? Very, very fortunate. But in other places, you got to look at the bigger picture and maybe a little more challenging. That's something your system should have in place. If it doesn't, as a good pre-op provider, you should be advocating for that. Like, why aren't we empowered? Why can't we have an automatic system by which we can do this, know where our resources are?
You should, if you don't really have it in writing, if there's no policy about what to do, you should seek that out and find it. You should be able to know what to do in those situations.
Right. And that's getting the doc on the line, right? Because the last thing that doc wants to do in your community hospital is be holding on to a stroke. He can't find a transfer. You know, and the liability in stroke care is very interesting. Historically, I haven't seen this redone in a couple of years, but looking at the medical malpractice risk of stroke care, you're far more apt to be held accountable and deemed negligent for lack of intervention, for omission of care, than someone who gets thrombolytics and they have a bleed in their head afterwards, right? It's better to go for it than to say, I couldn't get him out of here. I didn't want to give the thrombolytics. So, you know, any ER doc in a community hospital is going to be glad to get that patient, if it's safe, right? It's 9 hours in some incredibly rural areas to get somewhere. Maybe that's still a good choice if they can do endovascular. But again, I think making that decision is really important. Getting the doc on the phone, you know, the receiving hospital you might be going to, you know, they're going to be working to advocate for that patient also.
I'm picking out things that in your conversation I'd like to expand on a little bit. Let's do a little bit of A&P, the anterior versus the posterior strokes, before we lead into other things. And also, you had mentioned embolic strokes, and we have strokes that are ultimately ischemic versus hemorrhagic. So let's talk a little bit about stroke presentation. Everyone hears about that thunderclap or that worst headache you've ever had and hemorrhagic. And we also have a little bit of difference in the anterior and posterior. Let's dig into that a little.
All right. So let's break it down, as they say, a little bit. So let's again, as you said, you know, 80% of strokes are embolic. In other words, because there's a plaque somewhere, it breaks loose, it travels upstream, and it goes to like the narrowest point of the creek and it gets stuck there, right? So everything distal to it in the circulation loses blood flow. That's the classic embolic event.
Now, carotid and also AFib gets us involved in that?
Well, sure. Anything that sets you up for clot, right? So, you know, in the old days, you know, stroke risk was significant in the early birth control pills because estrogen, they were very estrogen heavy and they made you more prone to clot. So a lot of young women who had strokes from birth control pills, and I'm, you know, going back 30, 35 years, 40 years, when they were relatively new and the way they're not as well tweaked now. AFib is a big deal because you have clots that tend to accumulate in your atrium because you don't get that good squeeze every time. It kind of like the clots start to form up in here and they break loose. So I think that, you know, that's another great risk factor as well. And any previous history, you know, people with history of heart disease who have hardening of the arteries, atherosclerosis of the coronary vessels are often going to have hardening of their carotid vessels, right? And they may easily throw a plaque from there. So anybody with any history of vascular disease, whether cardiac or peripheral vascular disease, atrial fibrillation, lots of possibilities. And again, we watch TV. Well, I'm in a battleground state. So right now I watch TV at night. All you get is ads for that. But, you know, come second week in November, I'll be back to my drug ads all night, right? And they'll tell me about being on Eliquis and things like that for my, you know, and my clotting things because I'm in AFib. Because there is an increased risk, you know, 4 or 5 times increased risk for people in AFib for stroke than those of us who are not in atrial fibrillation. So again, yeah, those risk factors are definitely there. So a good history is important. But again, it's what's in front of you. You know, it is that looking hard at that patient. Look me right square in the eye. Smile for me. You know, I always, my face is a little asymmetric. It's always been that way. You know, I've had people say, have you had a stroke? I was like, no, I haven't had a stroke, but thanks for looking, right? Just some casual conversation. You know, so that facial asymmetry, really saying, I want you to repeat after me, is really important to say exactly back to me what I say to you. You can't teach an old dog new tricks, where it's always sunny in Philadelphia, whatever you want to pick. And it's amazing, you know, you have a stroke screen that, you know, they don't have any facial droop. They don't have any arm drift when we do this Cincinnati screen, but they're completely aphasic. They give you back gibberish and you say, oh, did I really just hear that? Let's do it one more time. You can't teach an old dog new tricks. And they're like, and you're like, wow, that's positive. And that's a 70% chance of stroke because you're in a speech center, right? So again, really, really important in that setting to look at that. So that's 80% of our embolic, but probably about 90%, 80 to 90% of embolic strokes are in the anterior circulation, which will give you a positive hit, so to speak, on your Cincinnati screen. However, 15, 20%, depending on how you look in populations, may be posterior circulation. So always think about the carotids, right? The carotids are the big deliverers of blood anteriorly in your neck to your brain, but you also have vertebral arteries in the back. You know, in the brain, there's a circle of Willis. It's like this. And the front is supplied by the carotids and the back is supplied by the vertebral arteries in the back. And vertebral arteries can get occluded also. So I have seen, and clearly there are strokes that may have a normal Cincinnati stroke screen because it's really screening for the anterior, but they have a posterior stroke. So the parts of the brain that are designed to be identified as at risk or ischemic in a Cincinnati stroke screen are different parts of the brain. So we're talking about visual cortex. So people talk about sudden visual changes. Right, that they you know, because our, even though the eyes are here, but the cortical center that runs your vision is in the back of your brain that takes a lot of posterior circulation. It's also about balance, right? Because it's about the cerebellum in the back that gives you so much balance stuff, and that's posterior circulation. So what I do in every single stroke patient I see, in every patient I'm screening for stroke, I make my residents do it. It drives them crazy. You know, I say, no, we're going to do these 5 things. I don't care what else you do for this person. We're going to do these 5 steps. Besides my Cincinnati stroke screen up front with the 3 things, is I make them look for these much less common posterior strokes. And that's really about finger to nose. I want you to touch your finger to your nose and then touch my finger. My finger is moving right, left, and they're going to reach out and touch it as they go. And then we do it on both sides, right? Not just one finger, nose, real quick, we're good. We're really going to do this right. Okay, with your right finger, I want you to touch your nose and touch my finger over here. Good. Over here. Good. Now let's do it on the other side. I want you to touch your nose with your left finger. Good. Now touch my finger here. Now touch my finger there. And if they pass it, if they can't hit that target, that's a sign of a posterior stroke. And then the other thing we do, and again, I would say, I think 95% of the stroke patients I screen, because, you know, gait can be a problem because it's cerebellum, but we don't usually walk patients a lot during a stroke screen. The other is the heel to shin, where you take your heel and slide it down the opposite shin and do it on the other side. That's also coordination in the cerebellum. And if they can't get that leg to get in position to go unilaterally down one of the shins, that's another positive finding. So I'm a big believer in the 5 steps. And even if you find, you know, you get a positive somewhere, I always go through those 5 steps to look at the circulation. So that's really about that. We've covered the 80% that are anterior, the 20% of the posterior, and then you talk about bleeds, right? So again, if 80% of all strokes, whether anterior or posterior circulation, are embolic, there's probably about 15 or 20% of strokes that are hemorrhagic. And it's a potpourri of, you know, stroke's a big term, right? In general, what we're looking at is hemorrhages, intracranial hemorrhages that are in the parenchyma of the brain. You look at the CAT scan, there's a big white blotch of blood there when you put them in the scanner because fresh blood is bright white. And generally, those people are at the exact same risk. Often hypertension is a much bigger part. So when I see a wildly hypertensive patient with stroke-like symptoms, I'm thinking they're probably hemorrhaging. When I see a really moribund, in other words, decreased glascocoma scale, can't even do the exam, right fixed gaze, left foot fixed gaze, that sort of stuff. I'm thinking about a hemorrhagic stroke. They complained they had a headache. Because generally, embolic strokes don't give you headaches. Hemorrhagic strokes, if they anger your dura, which has some pain sort of qualities too, you can see that. So the strokes in the brain themselves, those hemorrhagic strokes, are that percentage. And Dan, you talked about the thunderclap headache, right? That's the classic finding for a subarachnoid hemorrhage, which is really outside. It's inside the calvarium. It's still inside the skull, but it's really in that basic circulation with an aneurysm that blows out. And that's a very different looking patient, right? The subarachnoid patient's the person like, I was lifting weights, my head exploded. And they come in and they're like, oh, my God, my head, you know, and they may have cranial nerve deficits because a lot of the cranial nerves run along these aneurysms and things like that. And they look very uncomfortable. Oftentimes they have nuchal rigidity like meningitis because it's in the subarachnoid space. That blood goes down and irritates the neck also. So a lot of times they kind of hunch in like that. They don't want to move their neck because there's blood irritating their spinal cord because the blood is dissecting down also. So a lot of possibilities. But I think really talking about today about intraparenchymal true stroke in the brain tissue itself is really important.
All right. So as we do this, we've talked now, we've brought some A&P in, we've talked some of the numbers and things like that. The part that really struck me about when you talked about assessing really for any stroke, but you mentioned it a lot in the posterior strokes, checking both sides, the finger to nose, the heel. I mean, there's a certain amount of detail that I think people miss. And I think it's worth highlighting again that this is high stakes stuff and it's not something that we ever do casually.
Yeah, 100%. And again, strokes, almost always stroke is a unilateral phenomenon, right? And therefore, just having to do it on one side makes no sense whatsoever, right? Because you're a retired police officer. It's like only checking the suspect on one side of his body for a weapon. That's good. He had nothing on his left side. Why would he have anything on his right side? Right? Makes no sense, because it's a unilateral process. So again, you'd be amazed. It looks fabulous on one side and the other side is completely knocked out. So I think it's a really, really good point, Dan. And this is, you don't have to have OCD, to do it, but you have to do it well. You need to be in the game because again, God Almighty, this is about changing people's lives. This is about people on the precipice of a devastated life that you have as a provider in your hands by good assessment, by good triage, by lighting the fire, by notifying the hospital, by thinking about alternative destinations. You got a chance to pull this person right off that edge. It's the most amazing thing when you see patients, we fly them in, who are completely aphasic, have complete right side weakness. They get the clot pulled out and they leave the hospital 4 days later, neurologically intact. Oh my God, how great is that? But we all own that. And like you said, we own this. It's really, really important.
We look at some of the simple things that we do, the naloxone reversal of an opioid overdose or changing the hypoglycemic patient, getting them back on track, things that we see right in front of us. I think sometimes in EMS, we sometimes miss the long-term effects that we have in some of the decisions that we make. We're not doing the care ourselves, but I think that it makes a big difference. How about mimics? How do you handle stroke mimics in the emergency department?
Well, it takes me a long time. So I think the discussion of that which looks like a stroke that turns out not to be a stroke is a decision that has to be made after multiple hours in the ER. I think that in the pre-hospital arena, you should never say, it's a stroke mimic, we're done, right? It's a stroke and just get the patient to us, let us sort it out. So there's certain classic stroke mimics, right? There's the seizure patient who has a seizure, and because the foci of the brain where the seizure initiator had a lot more electrical activity, will have what they call the classic Todd's paralysis, right? So they have a seizure, and they have a weakness, unilateral weakness afterwards. That's called Todd's paralysis, which slowly gets better as the brain recovers from the electrical storm it just had in a seizure. There are atypical migraines that can really give you stroke-like symptoms, really impressively. There are a lot of possibilities there. But again, I'm going to really say you would not want to be my paramedic or my EMT in my service. And we have a discussion that you thought it was a stroke mimic and you thought you could triage it this way. dude, what are you thinking? Right. So I am always very, very resonant about making those mimic things. And again, sometimes, you know, I had one the other day, it was a seizure and it kind of looked like a stroke and we probably knew it was a Todd's paralysis, but the guy was, you know, in his 70s, you know, and he had a previous stroke. I'm not going to say that's going to be not that and still go the full nine yards and get him the CAT scanner, you know, give him contrast, look at his vasculature, get my stroke neurologist involved in the case. God bless you if you get the thing, it's a stroke mimic, but it's really, really important. The other thing that's really interesting, and I'll tell you this one, in an urban area, like I work in Philadelphia, I've worked here for, you know, 25 plus years, is that there's some people who like to get TPA. There's some very interesting people who mimic, are pretty good stroke fakers, and they like to get TPA. And we see these people intermittently every couple of years. There's someone who just got TPA 2 days ago at the academic center down the street, and they show up with stroke-like symptoms, happened 2 hours ago. They can do a good fake neuro exam. They fail their Cincinnati stroke screen. They get thrombolytics. There's some very strange people, and then there's kind of that psychiatric mimic, which a lot of people don't think about. But again, in our domain, that's at the way down at the end of the road. I got to do a lot of work before I get there. And again, when someone looks like they're having a stroke and you're at hour four, what are you going to do? You give thrombolytics. Until someone goes, hey, they just got TPA 2 weeks ago down, and then they had normal stroke studies. Something's wrong here. So we see a lot of crazy stuff sometimes. But again, that's more like, that's a good conversation to have around, you know, with a can of beer after work about these crazy cases you see. Yeah. Basic blocking and tackling, right? Do the five steps, have a high suspicion. And the other thing, you know, we got to talk about, and I know we will because I know you, we're going to talk about TIAs, right? And that's the other part of this. It's like the person who had those symptoms, even for 10 minutes, right? A lot of people think about TIA, transient ischemic attacks, as warning signs of a stroke, a warning thing, a syndrome. They're really strokes. They just got better, right? And because that little embolic thing that hit that part of the brain cleared and broke up or went on, something like that. And again, TIAs are a huge red flag. And you got to listen to the patient. You got to listen to the family. You get there and it's a crotchety old guy like me or like Dan Limmer. You don't want to get to Dan Limmer's house, open the door, he's crotchety, right? You get to Dan Limmer's house and he's like, I'm fine. And Stephanie says, no, he's not fine. He could not get words out for 10 minutes. And the answer is he had a TIA until proven otherwise. And if Dan doesn't want to go because he's crotchety, I'm going to pick up the phone. I'm going to call my local hospital. I'm going to hand the phone to Dan and say, Dan, this is Dr. Dickinson in the ER. You know, he really wants you to come and get evaluated. Because again, it's a shot across the bow. You know, those patients have a significant risk of subsequent real, quote, real strokes, real non-transient stroke, if you will, coming down the road in the next, 24, 48, 1 week, 2 week, things like that. And again, that's for us to assess and figure out in the emergency department. So again, huge proponent of never letting the TIAs go. You know, especially like change of shift TIA, I'm going to tell you that person has a risk of a less engaged EMS provider saying, they're fine, call back if it comes back. End of shift. Easier, less paperwork, no transport, whatever. I want to get home. Got to be on it. Got to take those very, very seriously as well.
So you say that you're number six, ultimately, capital letters in the paper Thanksgiving. A TIA is a stroke.
Right. We'll look it up.
Look at that as a stroke.
Google, now, look at the internet. Right. Go right to the NIH. And it defines a TIA is a stroke that is transient. But we look at MRIs and people who've had TIAs and we can see it on MRI on perfusion studies.
So get them to the hospital. The refusals 100%. Here are a very bad thing.
100%.
All right. Before I get into your number seven, I'm throwing some questions at you here we didn't talk about. What about, but going back a little bit to the mimics? Going back a little bit to the mimics, what about blood glucose and strokes? You know, there's a lot of mantras out there. Well, glucose is bad or whatever. And a lot of sources are saying, well, the patient should at least be normal glycemic. We don't want to make them hyperglycemic.
Yeah.
What's your thinking on that?
Yeah, I think so. It's interesting. So one of the things we look at that we do see in patients, let's take a category of patients who've had strokes, who once again come back with stroke-like symptoms. We scan the brain, we do the whole nine yards, we don't see a lot going on. And one of the things that neurologists always talk to about, what causes a recurrence of stroke-like symptoms? And the one that's always very large in their book is infection. So a elderly person with a previous stroke who represents with stroke-like symptoms, yet we MRI them and there's no stroke, we're looking for other things that have once again challenged that part of the brain to succeed. And oftentimes infection is a big part of that. So our older patients, they're always getting chest x-rays, they're getting urinalysis, looking for signs of infection. And people with UTIs, complex UTIs, can have what appears to be a stroke-like syndrome, again, a mimic, as you will. But they've already had a stroke. It's just really challenging that part of the brain that was damaged previously. I think that's important. I think glucose and focality is unusual but not impossible. To really look like a stroke when your glucose is low. I mean, we check everyone's glucose. EMS is great. They have the glucose. They know the report when they come in the door and they say the glucose is 153. So we know that you can have subtle sort of findings. I would say in my experience, I think maybe in yours too, Dan, agitation is far more a common presenter of, in general, confusion. A global picture of neurological derangement is probably more common in hypoglycemia than is focality, to have a positive sensation stroke screen because your glucose is 82. Maybe you can't follow the directions well because you're so confused because your glucose is low. So yeah, absolutely. You're 100% right. A finger stick and an AccuCheck is essential on the front end of these patients for assessment. And then what's okay, right? So if the sugar is 88, I bet you that's not what the problem is. The sugar is 26. Yeah, they should get some dextrose before they, you know, get too far into your doors or out of the care in EMS. But again, a lot of sugar is not good for you in stroke. And we know that because of permeability issues, right? So we don't want a person who has a glucose of 99 and we give an AMPA D50. That's probably a mistake because they really don't need to have a new blood glucose of 350 because you just slammed them with 25 grams of glucose of dextrose. You know, probably don't need that. So again, judicious use of glucose, absolutely. Thinking about it in the differential, absolutely. And again, it's a weapon you have in your armamentarium as a pre-hospital provider, you know, at the EMT, at the AMT, the paramedic level.
All right. That covers a lot of the stuff, but you say that there's some trauma things we need to talk about with stroke. And I think that's a great one here to finish up our seven things. And so who doesn't love trauma? The risk of stroke and trauma? Tell us about it.
So it's interesting. So and it's funny. I think about a story where a patient who was in a motor vehicle crash, pretty high mechanism, presented with stroke-like symptoms, and everyone assumed, you know, that the crash was caused by the person having a stroke. And we do see that, right? We see it all the time, like syncope crash, stroke crash, right? Because you lose control of the vehicle and that can happen. But the assumption was that the crash happened because of them having an antecedent stroke or preceding stroke, and then they crashed their car. However, again, talking about posterior circulation and those sort of things, we see in the setting of trauma and usually high mechanisms. And when Dan and I were children in the dark ages, when we were still developing knives and forks and things, right? We were young, as young paramedics together.
Yeah, long ago.
Well, long ago in a galaxy far, far away. But anyway, you know, we were kind of in that mode of, you know, seatbelt signs. And we saw a seatbelt sign on someone's abdomen. And we said, oh, back injury, you know, chance fracture, intra-abdominal injuries, hollow viscous, solid viscous, those sorts of things, right? And now that there are almost no lap belt only vehicles left on the road, occasionally a rural community might have an old F-150 out there that has it. But generally, we don't see just isolated abdominal seatbelt signs. But we do see a lot of seatbelt signs up high, riding seatbelt signs, right? Above the clavicle in this area. So you take a look at someone's neck, and a good trauma exam needs, before you throw the collar on someone, expose this stuff out. Do you see a high riding seatbelt sign? And what's really emerged is interesting is that seatbelt, shoulder straps from seatbelts can cause direct vascular injury in high mechanism. So if you have, you know, you normally our seatbelts, like, you know, my Volvo, it pulls me back, don't get seatbelt signs. If I see a seatbelt mark on someone's neck, when they get to the trauma center, they're getting specific different studies of their neck. We do CT angios of their neck to look for injuries to the carotid arteries, anterior circulation, and the vertebral arteries, posterior circulation, because you get these interesting injuries where there's damage to the vessel, it's not like it's ripped in half, but you get these flaps, intimal flaps, because of the trauma and the energy directly to the blood vessel. And they may stroke because of that. So you'll see these patients come in with stroke-like symptoms, high-riding seatbelt signs. And they did a study a while ago, and it's not like every one of them by any means. It's fairly unusual. You know, maybe, you know, one in 75 or 100 stroke scans that we do, or excuse me, angios we do, when we see this thing. But when you find it, it's really important, because if they're neurologically intact now, but they have this intimal flap, this new sort of like thing going to cause turbulence and clot in their neck, in their carotid, or in the vertebral artery, we need to know about that and start treating that right away. And interestingly, in the setting of trauma, the way you treat a intimal injury after a carotid injury or a vertebral injury where there's this intimal flap floating around, we actually put them on antiplatelet agents. We make sure they don't form clots on this flap. Rarely is it repaired, but normally they go on anti, you know, it's kind of counterintuitive. You're thinning people's bloods out, so to speak, who are trauma patients, but you got to find that injury. So really, really important. And again, another quick case story, the patient who was in a motor vehicle crash 2 days ago, and I remember this case like it was yesterday, Dodge Neon, one of those little vehicles, car was decimated. The patient refused transport, but they had a big seatbelt markup in here, but still refused transport. And 2 days later presented with stroke-like symptoms because they stroked, because they had the injury at the time of the crash. Took a little while for those platelets to junk up on top of that ripped part of the artery, and then they stroked. So again, really, really important.
So that kicked loose, like, that clot kicked loose.
Yep, that clot, and it traveled, right? And it's not a hemorrhagic stroke. It's an embolic stroke at that point, which is really interesting, right, in the setting of trauma. And I think it's the exact same thing I said about the TIA, right? You go to a person, you say, you know, you really need to go to the hospital. You're going to talk to my doc. I'm not going to let you go until you talk to my doc to make sure you understand all the risks that you could have a real stroke here. And you could end up, you know, permanently being, you know, with a feeding tube, a disastrous sort of thing, and dead even. Same thing in motor vehicle crashes. When I see somebody who's signing off against advice, and I always look at their neck before I am signing the paper. Can I just look at your neck real quick? And I see a seatbelt sign. I'm telling them, look, that's worrisome. It may not be that injury, but the fact that there's that much energy applied to your neck and do a lot of damage down deep, this is not the time to blow it off and say, you know, because I know I'm already in trouble because I crashed my car. You need to go to the hospital, get a good evaluation, make sure there's nothing else going on.
Wow. I think that there's really an incredible amount of things we've talked about here that could change practice in EMS. I mean, I don't think there's a lot of people that look at that seatbelt sign and make the connections that you just made there. So there's a high risk in refusals. You're saying that if you have these patients and they refuse, reach out to medical control, reach out to the doc at the hospital, get somebody on the phone and get them to come in if you can.
Yeah, and document those conversations to protect yourself. I clearly advise the patient, because of this injury to the neck, they're citing against advice at risk of death. And, you know, and people never want to be confrontational with refusal of care forms. You write the word death on every single refusal form you ever write. You know, so I don't care what it is. You know, you need to have that there. You need, because they really need to understand what that means. You know, they need to repeat it back to you. That, you know, I understand, yeah, I could get a stroke and die, whatever, fine. And again, if they don't have the capacity to sign the refusal form, then they don't have the capacity to sign the refusal form, it's not an issue, you got to transport them to the hospital. So I think it is really important because, and again, these are, as I think you just said, this is very a high stakes game, right? This isn't little stuff. This is really high stakes about changing people's lives and changing their families' lives. Right, losing the breadwinner. Now I got to take care of my dad because he had a stroke. You know, now I got to take care of my mom because she had a stroke. Again, you know, I always think about golden rules of care. Right, it's airway, breathing, circulation. It's about scene safety, your safety first, no matter what the situation is. Right, whatever that means. It's about ABCs or CABs or however we do it these days, depending on what your situation is. Right, and it's about always presuming the worst. Always presuming the worst. For a given situation, for a complex of symptoms. That's how we work in the ER. Okay, you're having active chest pain. We're going to get an EKG in the first 5 minutes. We're going to make sure it's not a STEMI. And we'll work our way back from there. And it may turn out to be a muscle strain. Great, we got to that point. But we're always presuming the worst, never blowing it off, never saying, it's a stroke mimic. It's a stroke until it's not a stroke, right? High mechanism injuries, look at these sort of high riding seatbelt signs. That's a real important finding. And we don't talk about that. You know, both of us are National Registry paramedics, you know, and we don't, that's not a, when we go down the neck in a trauma site, a trauma survey on an exam, we say trachea's midline, no JVD, and we move on, right? We don't talk about trachea's midline, no JVD, I see no high riding seatbelt signs. We don't talk about that. We should. That should be part of your secondary survey, 100% in your head to toe in a trauma assessment. And we should incorporate that in the way we teach.
Fascinating. I'm going to ask you one more question. One of the things I found that EMS people, when we look at risk factors, when we look at hypertension, we look at diabetes, we look at things give us vascular potential issues.
High cholesterol, right?
High cholesterol. And what do? We check the boxes in our on our report, but we don't make them relevant. We don't apply them to this patient who has these signs and symptoms. How do you, as an emergency physician, weigh those things? How much does it go into your thing? And what should EMS really be doing with someone who has a lot of risk factors, the cholesterol, the blood pressure, the smoker, the all those things?
Yeah, I think they're important. You know, the classic teaching of medicine is 85% of the diagnosis is history, right? And it's history of the present illness, what happened today. And it's looking at the complex of who are you? You're an organism, right? We're all organisms. Some of us are more organisms than other people, as you well know. But anyway.
That's another podcast.
Another podcast. But, you know, the bottom line is that that's important information. I remember I used to work my first job as a paramedic was for a commercial ambulance service. And I remember this day in the back of the bus driving down the road for a transport, just writing down the initials, HTN, DM, HC, you know, high class. It was irrelevant to me about my taking care of my patient, right? It never struck me that was an important sort of thing. But you got to look at those risk factors. They are real, you know, and on the front side, on a preventive health side, our ability to attenuate those symptoms, control blood pressure, to control cholesterol, to more narrowly manage diabetes. So you're more euglycemic than you're hyper or hypoglycemic, right? So the hyperglycemic, they all do damage. You know, you look at things like AAAs, right? What do we do now? If you have a history of smoking, you're over 50, insurance now pays for you to get that abdominal ultrasound to make sure you don't have an abdominal aortic aneurysm. Because basically people who are, if they don't have Marfan's disease or some of the collagen vascular rare disease, or they weren't smokers, you don't get a AAA. But we now know that, you know, Dan, you and I, in the old days, we'd see ruptured AAAs all the time. You know, we don't see that many of them anymore because they're being monitored. Because everyone knows if you're a smoker and had any history of smoking, you're over 50, we're going to start looking at that. We're going to start looking at your aorta with an ultrasound. Yeah, so I think it's really important. And again, it's that difference, right? It's about Ed Dickinson as a young paramedic just writing down letters because they don't mean anything, but not really understanding what that means, right? In our approach and our mindset. And maybe that argument with the patient, you know, not the argument, the discussion once refused. Hey, Dan, you've got high blood pressure, high cholesterol, you got diabetes, you know, you smoke like a chimney. These are real risk factors that I really think these symptoms could be really a sign of something dangerous. That much said, may sway them to go to the hospital. You know, and again, when I have a discussion with a colleague about admitting someone or doing a part of a workup or bringing a consultant in, I say, hey, listen, they're a smoker, high cholesterol, you know, previous coronary artery disease. And then all of a sudden the lights go on and people's heads like, oh yeah, that does make sense. They really are a great risk for that. And one of the things to do, you know, whenever we see a stroke patient, you know, and we're managing them, or a TIA patient, we're managing them, besides getting them on stronger antiplatelet therapies, suddenly if they're on Lipitor at 20 a day, like I am, they automatically go to 80 a day. It really makes a difference because the literature shows you put them on a high dose statin makes a difference in reducing the risk moving forward. So yeah, it's not unidimensional. It's not the simple boxes, but it's a comprehensive approach to the whole organism. And we're not all the same, right? We're all different.
No, it's true. All right, we're at the end now. What I generally do is I give our guests the opportunity for a last word. What would you want, you know, primacy and recency? What would you want people to hear last? What's the message from the ER doc at Penn as people are about to take the test and get some CE from this or finish up their listening experience? What would you say? What's your last word?
I think again, we're so fortunate that we live in 2024, that we have all these resources for our patients, for our families, for ourselves, right? That's a gift. That's a gift that's been hard fought through a lot of research and through a lot of people who were devastated by strokes and people were in stroke trials and went this way or that way. This is a massive life-changing set of diseases. And our job is to take it very seriously, to always err on the side of caution and say, looks like a stroke. This maybe it was a TIA. It's the real deal. Right? We're always going to presume the worst in this neurological venue. We're never going to deprive a patient of the opportunity to end up in the right ER at the right time with the right teams to manage them. And again, we're a huge, diverse country with all sorts of EMS systems and all sorts of transport times and things like that, but really figured out how you can do it best. You know, you're not going to have the same door to CAT scan time that I do because I can, you know, with a good wedge shot, I can hit the hospital from here, right? you're not going to all have that opportunity, but what can you do as an advocate for your patients to optimize the chance of them having the best possible outcome when they've actually had a stroke? It's so important, Dan. It just, again, it's our obligation to our fellow man. And again, it's a gift, and we can't squander gifts, for sure.
I love it. It's a great way to wrap it up. We're going to call this podcast to wrap. Dr. Ed Dickinson from Penn, longtime friend, medical editor for the Emergency Care EMT book, the Yellow Book. For those of you who don't know, we've been doing that for a long time together as well. This is a great episode, and I thank you very much for coming by.
Dan, always a pleasure. I'll see you again. Take care.
Thank you for listening to a 7 Things EMS podcast by Limmer Education. If you've listened to this podcast on a streaming service and you're interested in getting continuing education credit, please go to lc-ready.com for more information.